It's Let's Talk Legal on the Talk Station FM 107.1. And joining us this afternoon, we have Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins of Harvell and Collins. And I do want to remind you, the number, 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050. And of course, online at harvellandcollins.com. Spell out the word and, please, Harvell, A-N-D, Collins. com. And with that, Cecil, Wes, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Lockwood. Wes and I are off and rolling here in 2025. Off and running, I might add. But last week, we talked about the administration of an estate, which is a big word, but basically just settling an estate, getting assets passed on to the appropriate people, per a last will and testament, hopefully, or if not, then pursuant to statute in North Carolina. And we talked about the process, and we did get through some of the information. And one of the things that we talked about last week, I'll just say real quickly, is that we talked about the fact, Lockwood, that it all begins with accountability mm-hmm. with the Superior Court of North Carolina, because they're not going to give authority, known as a letters testamentary or letters of administration, to an individual or corporation, if it's a bank or something like that, until such time as there has been appropriate qualification. And qualification meaning, you know, the document is the original document, the appropriate person has signed an oath saying that they will faithfully and dutifully follow the document, that they will respond to the Superior Court if there are questions, they'll file their accountings on time, things of this nature. So there is this accountability that is established. There's this quid pro quo back and forth, if you will, between the executor. I use that word mostly because people know what that word means, the executor, and, of course, the Superior Court of North Carolina. This holds the process, if you will, Lockwood, in check. And that's what we want, so that we don't have to go out there and hire litigation lawyers like mm-hmm. Mr. Collins.
We represent estates, and we represent folks who are beneficiaries of estates, Lockwood. That's kind of an easy way to explain. And it's a very interesting dynamic that, you know, when we are on the inside, this is when we're representing the executor or the trustee or whoever the fiduciary is, who has a responsibility for properly administering the estate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that is, I call that, we're on the inside looking out, okay? And basically what we're doing in that situation is the North Carolina General Statutes are specific under North Carolina General Statute 28A and all the subparts, or North Carolina General Statute 36C and all the subparts with regard to trust and the job that they're required to do with regard to inventories that should be, and when we do them are, based on the information we gather, accurate, based on the accountings that are provided, based on, you know, the debts that we're paying from the estate. Everything that we do has to be transparent, open, proper, filed with the court so that everyone can see, you know, what we're doing. So, and in the event that there's a failure to do that, which sometimes folks, when they try to deal with estates on their own, it is in many cases not their fault. It's just a complicated thing. Mm-hmm. I would say it's more complicated. Well, it's not, I would say it is more complicated than it has ever been as far as the standard that's required by the court to properly account and administer an estate. But then on the flip side of that, we oftentimes represent folks who are on the outside looking in. You know, these would be beneficiaries of a trust. It would be beneficiaries of an estate, you know, through a will or through intestate heirs and their rights in the estate. So what they're doing is if we represent them, we're making sure that the fiduciary, who is the executor, administrator, trustee, to name a few, are specifically following those statutes and doing their job as required by law. Because really, what those statutes and laws require the folks to do is to be fair, proper, consistent with the governing document, equitable, and to be transparent. And in the event that whoever's in control of the estate and is on the inside, as I've said, fails to do that, then there is accountability. It could even become personal accountability, depending on how egregious the acts are. We've certainly had cases where I've been able to get folks, as I say, sometimes popped for attorney's fees because they haven't done things properly, even after we've given them opportunity to do so. Furthermore, in the event that you have a trustee or you have an executor, for example, who has breached their duty, then there are processes for having them removed. Mm-hmm. Now, just because you're a little bit late on providing some information, or just because things are moving slowly, that normally is not good enough to have a fiduciary removed. Because you have to understand, Lockwood, that whoever this fiduciary is, if they're under a trust or they're under a will, which is where they're going to be appointed in most cases, well, the person who is no longer with us, the person who died, who set up this trust or set up this will, they decided who they wanted their trustee or executor to be. So they're not with us anymore. So we give a lot of credit to and support to whomever, or their choice with regard to whomever they selected. So we can't just willy-nilly, based on something minor or something that upsets a beneficiary, remove these folks. You have to have something that's pretty egregious in order to have them removed. And as far as the removal process goes, my goodness, we've had these kind of cases where they're simple, where it's simple, and it's a very little discovery, and it's petition to revoke letters or petition to remove trustee, and we have a hearing, and we have good evidence, and the court removes them. And we've had these kind of cases that drag on and on and on and on because it is World War III fight over these things. So, but the bottom line, as Cecil mentioned, the topic he wanted me to touch on with regard to that was the kind of the transparency issue, is that, you know, whether you're on the inside or whether you're on the outside of this administration, whether it's a trust or an estate, really we should all want transparency. We should all want, you know, everything to be done above board and to be transparent. Another dynamic that's interesting is that if you're on the outside looking in, Lockwood, if we represent someone who's a beneficiary but not in control of the estate, we have to be very careful with regard to how much we're going to stir things up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, frankly, in many cases, we're wanting to stand on the sideline and watch and make sure everything's done right. And then if it's not, we'll address it. But we certainly don't want to frustrate the efforts of the fiduciary in doing their job. Why is that? Because if the fiduciary has an attorney, well, the more work that we create by, you know, litigating an issue or whatever, well, the more attorney fees that they're going to be charged against that estate. Okay? That estate, which if we're a beneficiary of that estate, we're essentially taking money out of our own pocket.
Right.
You follow what I'm saying there?
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be careful about that. And it's important to let the fiduciary on the inside know that we're involved, and that we're monitoring things, but not necessarily, you know, to, you know, file motions and things like that until we have very, you know, good evidence to support what we're doing, because there is a additional reason why we want to be super efficient if we're on the outside looking in. We just don't want to, you know, kind of stir things up when we're when we know that that's going to create some expense, because it just does. And it is certainly proper in most cases for the executor or the trustee to charge against the trust or the estate assets, as it may be, for that expense, which, you know, if we're a, let's say we're a one-third beneficiary of an estate, and the attorney's fees are $10,000 for whatever the issue is going on, well, that's taken $3,333.33 out of our pocket.
Right.
Because that's one-third less of an inheritance we'll receive. Mm-hmm. Some people are shocked when they hear, well, hold on a second. He's doing everything wrong as the executor and charging attorney's fees against my inheritance. He can't do that. Well, yeah, he can. That's just the way that works. So,
Lockwood, here are some of the other, like, key questions that we get that I want to try to get through a couple of them, two or three of them maybe, real quick. Number one, how long does it take to settle an estate? You know, we get that question very, very often. And, of course, let's just say that right out of the gate, you know, we have a three-month period of time from the time of qualification, 3 months out, for creditors to make their claim. So clearly an estate is going to be open for 3 months, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, after the three-month period, we can, as a law firm, move the file in the fourth and fifth and 6 months to closure. And we often do that. But sometimes we have the tax guy,
right,
if you will,
yeah,
our tax friend,
uh-huh,
just waiting. For instance, let's say that just right now, for instance, just yesterday I had this question. Our loved one died, you know, in the 1st of January. The family was in our office yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the 3 months is going to be, you know, April. I mean, we probably can move the file and possibly have closure, you know, June, July. But guess what? It's not time, you know, we've got a leg on with regard to a tax year, 2025.
Right.
And there was some activity in 2025. So that estate is going to linger on, not, and I want to make a distinction here in a moment, but that estate in terms of finality with the clerk of court,
mm-hmm,
it's probably going to have to wait until the tax filings are complete, which can sometimes be a much later date. Now, here comes the distinction, Lockwood. This doesn't mean that we even wait 3 months to start, you know, distributing, getting notice testamentary to the banks, to the stock companies, you know, death certificates where they belong, things of that nature. We begin the work immediately once we have the letters testamentary, the letters of administration. Immediately we start processing the assets and getting them into a posture to be distributed. It's not like we just twiddle our thumbs for three months and wait for those 3 months to expire and then begin work. Absolutely not. So if we, which we always are, and so are our clients, of course, organized because we're guiding them and leading them, you know, we usually have a lot of the work done within the first 3 or 4 months, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we're geared up and we're ready for distribution per the estate documents or the statute of North Carolina. So we move the file immediately, but in terms of this clocking in a finality, that is a different issue. That might linger forward a little bit. Another question, a very common question that touches back to what Wes was talking about, you know, is, Mr. Harville, am I entitled to an executor's commission? And the answer to that question is that you absolutely are, and the clerk of court will award you an executor's commission, and it is anywhere from, let's say, 3 to 5% of the liquidity in the estate, the assets of a liquid nature that pass through the estate. So it's going to exclude life insurance. and it's going to exclude, for instance, say, an IRA or a retirement account. It also excludes real property, our home, our land. The commission is not figured, it's not computed, based on the value of the home place or the condominium or the investment property, anything of land nature. Now, if the executor is instructed to sell the land and reduce it to cash, and then and the will states that and or trust, then now it's a different situation. The fiduciary has been instructed to reduce the asset to cash, and now it would become a liquid asset, and the commission would apply. Now, the reason I say 3 to 5% is only because of something that Wes just mentioned. Sometimes in an estate, folks will feel that they really do need the guidance of an attorney to keep things on track, dot the I's, cross the T's. And if an attorney has been significantly involved in the file and has been billing on an hourly rate against the estate, then the clerk of court might not, in addition to the attorney fee, feel comfortable awarding a full 5%. Now, sometimes they do, depending on the circumstances. And we have a file in our office right now where we usually these files for the full 5% plus attorney fees are usually very significant files, mm-hmm. or complicated estates. And we have one right now in our office where we fully intend, even though the law firm has charged hourly rates and they're not insignificant, we absolutely intend to go to the clerk. And even if we need to get Mr. Collins to go to the hearing and petition for the full 5% for this particular gentleman who has worked just an astonishing right. amount of hours on right. this particular mm-hmm. estate, I might add, over and beyond what we as the law firm have needed to do.
Right.
We as the law firm have handled the legal concerns, which have been significant, but this particular decedent had extraordinary personal property. I'm talking about tangible things, uh-huh. art, antiques, jewelry. And all of these items were going to a myriad of different beneficiaries, many in different states. They needed to be appraised. Some of them had very significant value. A couple of pieces that are mentioned in the estate documents could not be located. So this poor executor has worked just hours and hours and hours assimilating and distributing all of this personal property, not to mention the fact that there's were multiple real estates that he had to manage. And so this gentleman, if anyone was ever entitled to 5%, it would be this person,
yeah.
even though we also have attorney fees in the estate. But the bottom line is a commission is awarded, and so that is a question that we get. I would put a ballpark on the finality of an estate, Lockwood. I know we may be coming up a little bit short on time, but
no,
I would put a ballpark, I would say, anywhere from about 9 months from the date of death, maybe. Again, now that doesn't mean that accounts and banks and stock companies mm-hmm. and cars are not going to be distributed much sooner. But in terms of finality at the courthouse, maybe 9 months to a year. And again, that can depend on the timing of the tax filings.
I want to go to the finality of the estate. I'm wondering, related to our good friends at IRS, they're always here to help us. When we close an estate, what are the chances of the estate being challenged a couple of years later by the IRS? One of the great concerns is that when we close the door on the estate, we can lock it. We can walk away from it.
Well, we, of course, want to mitigate that possibility.
Right. Well, I can appreciate that.
Right out of the gate, are able to discern whether or not there is a tax filing. And what kind of tax filing that might be. the most common tax, there are two very common tax filings in an estate. Number one is just making sure that the last 1040 of the decedent is appropriately filed and is marked as a final return to close down that Social Security number, if you will, with the Internal Revenue and with the Department of Revenue. That's the first filing. The second filing that is common that we are certainly attuned to is called an income tax return for the fiduciary or a fiduciary income tax return. And this is where during dependency of the estate due to the nature of the investments, be it CDs or bank accounts or stock company or stocks, whatever the case might be, the estate has generated income exceeding $700. And if that's the case, which it doesn't take a whole lot of money a whole lot of investment portfolio to create that kind of income, then that income, you see, Lockwood, would not be captured with the decedent because they're no longer living. It's captured during the pendency of the administration of the estate, which is what our topic is today. And so we would see to the fact that there is a fiduciary income tax return filed. There's usually no tax with regard to that income tax return because it's offset by expenses of the estate. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line is it's our duty as the lawyer to see that it gets filed. So there's two returns that we're on high alert for. Number one is the last 1040, as you would expect, of the decedent. Number two would be an income tax return. Now, Lockwood, you know, and Wes knows, and I think a lot of our listeners know, it's very rare now for us to file a 706 or an estate tax return because the threshold, the exemption equivalent amount for an estate now, $14-15 million and counting, there just are not but so many estates that come in at that kind of number. Let me be more precise. Unless an estate has assets that exceed this $15 million number, then there's no, not only is there no expense, there's no filing of an estate tax return. So in our office, we certainly have files that exceed that amount, and we do, and then we have a third return that we're on guard for. But most estates do not exceed that multimillion-dollar level. Just to give that context, because I know our listeners sometimes just can't even believe what they're hearing because this is what happens in the law firm every day. They remember $600,000 Lockwood, and it was $600,000 for years and years and years. It was $600,000. Then it went up to $1 million, went up to $1.5 million, went up to maybe $2-2.5 million. But my goodness, in this world now with inflation, the number has escalated up to the $14-15 million level. Most of our listeners just don't know that. Yeah. There has not been, an excessive amount of news about that. Mm-hmm. It's not something that our Congress goes about bragging about the fact that estate tax is so very high. The exemption equivalent amount is so very high. It just kind of happened in the middle of the night. But it is the fact that unless an estate exceeds these very significant numbers, there's not going to be that tax filing.
Okay.
Now, your question was a little bit different. It was a little bit like, well, what if you close out the estate and then a year later or a couple of years later, you get a notice from the IRS that they didn't receive something? And that does happen, Lockwood, and we do have those things that happen. We've had one just recently. We then have to reopen the estate because we have to get that accountability established again.
Right.
How in the world can the executor write a letter to the Internal Revenue Service and answer their questions and or make it a filing that maybe didn't get made unless they have the authority to do it? And so we have to reestablish that authority with letters of administration or letters testamentary, and then they have to make an answer to the Internal Revenue Service. And I might add, we have that happen not just with the IRS, but with any number of different. Maybe an account didn't close. Maybe a particular investment was not captured or known about. The one in the office right now that comes to mind is we have a decedent that happened to own an interest in an oil rig and had some oil mineral rights interest, but yet no one ever knew it.
Right.
Okay, but now we know it, and we need to reopen the estate and reestablish that and get those assets passed on to the heirs.
Does the executor basically swear an oath to the court? And I'm thinking, if that's the case, then in essence, this individual now has dutiful responsibility to the court as well as to the estate.
That's exactly what Wes and I have been explaining, is that this executor, this person, has an absolute legal obligation to not only do appropriate accountings, but to respond to the court. If they don't, and this happens all the time, Lockwood, I mean, that might sound like the folks that they don't, that they don't think this happens, but it absolutely happens. The sheriff goes out and serves the executor with notice that there will be a hearing as to why you, executor, have not filed your accounting, or as to why you, executor, here we are at over a year, and you have not closed the estate. What is going on here? You have accountability to us, the Superior Court of North Carolina. We don't have the filings. So, Mr. or Mrs. Executor, where are they? And we want to know now, within 10 days, and the sheriff is at your doorstep to summon you to the courthouse to answer those questions. And that is a routine thing that happens all of the time.
I would assume that it's an important aspect, and we may want to make this another conversation in the future. I think it's an important, I'm assuming it's an important conversation for the principal, the benefactor, I guess, or the individual whose will is going to be intestate, make sure that they have an agreement with that executor. Because as you just pointed out, there's an executor here that you're dealing with who has put in tremendous amount of time and effort, probably at his own expense or her own expense. This is not something that should be taken lightly.
That's correct.
So if somebody is selected as an executor and they're meeting with you, and is it helpful to have that executor also meet with you in advance, obviously, as the will is being discussed?
Yes. The executor sometimes, Lockwood, as you would expect, we have just every permutation of this.
Right.
Sometimes good families will come in, dad is, in hospice, Mr. Orville.
Right.
He's not going to make it. I would like to, look at the original will. I want to get organized with you. Tell me what to do. And yet, their loved one is not even at that point, has not necessarily passed on. And then, of course, we have files where let me say this real quick, where they come in, what you would expect on a timely basis. And then remember last week, Wes brought up, we discussed that someone came in 4 or 5 years later. They just didn't think they needed to open up an estate. Things were what they were, and then the bottom line is that they just until there was a letter from maybe the IRS, as you mentioned, or a letter from a stock investment or something of that nature, they just never opened up an estate. And here we are 3, 4, 5 years later.
Oh.
So it can take any combination of facts.
All right. So as we wrap it up with Wes Collins and Cecil Harvell, and that was Cecil Harvell of Harvell and Collins, I think this is a concluding remark that it pays to make the phone call. 252 area code 726-9050, 726-9050, or go online to harvellandcollins.com and spell out the word and, please. Cecil, Wes, thanks very much for your time today.
Okay. Thank you, Lockwood.
Lockwood.